This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailhards on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. On the program today, another example of drought and high water prices playing out in northern Victoria. Around 30,000 cows have been sold out of the Cahoona district alone over the course of the past year and a half. Now, some of these cows were culls that would have been sold anyway, but a significant number were core breeding stock as well. So we'll talk about the implications on that. Also on the program today, there has, of course, been plenty of talk about the Mandatory Dairy Code, which is meant to try and level the playing field between farmers and processors. Well, now one processor says the code doesn't go far enough. To start today, though, an estimated 75,000 backpackers could receive hundreds of millions of dollars from the tax office after the federal court ruled that the government's so-called backpacker tax was invalid. Our Parliament House reporter, Kath Sullivan, has been looking at this and joins us. And Kath, with a lot of this tax stuff, this gets pretty complicated pretty quickly.
Absolutely, Nikolai. And you could be forgiven for not, in fact, being aware that this court case was even on. When we got in touch with several groups yesterday looking for reaction and response to this, it came to light that many people sort of knew that there had been a federal court case on in the background, but very few were expecting the ruling yesterday, and it's caught a lot of people unaware. Basically, you might recall that in 2016, or 2015 it was, in the budget of 2015, the federal government proposed a tax on backpackers. And there was enormous brouhaha about how this was to be charged. And there was lots of angst, particularly in the farming sector, because farmers feared that this would be a massive deterrent for backpackers coming to Australia. As you know, a lot of horticulture in particular does rely on backpacker labour to help harvest crops, particularly in the summertime, sort of this time of year that we're coming into now. So it'd been very controversial from the get-go. But it was actually this case that was brought forward by an overseas tax advisory firm. It's called TaxBack.com. And it launched this legal action in the federal court, suggesting that the tax was discriminatory based on nationality. And in his ruling yesterday, Justice John Logan found that in the case of one woman, Catherine Addy, who was the test case, the tax was a disguised form of discrimination based on nationality. And this is actually, according to Justice John Logan, discrimination that's prohibited by Australia's tax agreements and tax treaties. Now, the case actually applied to people from eight nationalities, which we understand make up about half of the backpacker labour force here in Australia. And those countries included the United Kingdom and the United States, as well as Turkey and some other nationalities. So, it's been a long road to get to where we are today, but it sounds like this could just be kicking off, Nikolai, and there could be a lot more to come.
And I imagine that the person that was putting this test case forward would presumably be pretty happy with the outcome then.
Yeah, well, you know, and having a listen to her lawyers, or to TaxBack.com, the company that brought the litigation in the Australian court, this is recognition of what they say was a very unjust way of taxing backpackers. What it sort of found was that backpackers were being taxed before they reached a certain threshold, whereas Australian workers doing the same job were not taxed until they had at least earned, I think it's $18,200. Now, our colleagues at RN had a chat to TaxBack CEO, TaxBack.com's chief executive, Joanna Murphy, this morning, and asked her what she actually thought the cost of this tax might have been and what the Australian government might be looking to pay back. Here's Joanna Murphy from TaxBack.com.
I mean, it's really difficult to tell at this juncture. I suppose at the outset, the tax office had estimated that this revenue, that the taxation revenue would be in excess of 500 million per annum. And the eight countries in our test case, which have non-discriminatory clauses in their taxation treaties, would represent about 50% of that. So we would imagine that it's in the order of about 300 million. That's possible. But we don't expect, I guess, that it would be exactly to that magnitude.
That's Joanna Murphy from taxback.com.
So the question then, I suppose, is whether or not these people that have been affected will get repaid, and that's still a bit uncertain.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of a response from the federal government yesterday, the Treasurer deferred comment to his assistant, Michael Sukkar, who said that he would be deferring any comment until the Australian Tax Office ruled whether or not it was likely to appeal or challenge the findings in the federal court yesterday. Now, obviously, this is a bit of a concern for people who rely on backpacker labour. Tony Maher from the National Farmers Federation yesterday was saying that this does create some more uncertainty, and that is something that farmers obviously don't want, particularly at a time when they're coming into summer harvest and relying so heavily on having backpackers come to Australia. And I also asked Tony Maher about the impact that the tax has had. Now, this was legislated in late 2016. I think it was the last sitting year. There were all sorts of deals going on in terms of the backpacker tax and at what rate it would be charged. The National Farmers Federation at one point said it would back in a 19% tax. In the end, it was brought to 15%. And Tony Maher said that the impact of that tax, which was introduced in 2017, was that backpacker numbers had actually fallen away, although that had started to increase and that had turned around in more recent times. So it's really interesting to see how these policy decisions here are affecting all sorts of areas of the Australian economy, I suppose.
And I guess that in a sense really is the bottom line too, is whether or not this court decision will lure more backpackers back to farms and will help fill those labour shortages that we hear so much about.
I think in some instances, the drought has lessened the demand or the call for backpacker labour at the moment. But if we were to be having a fantastic season and a fantastic year where yields were really high, this could be something that would really be tested at the moment. And of course, we know that the National Farmers Federation has been leading a call for a specific visa that would create a new sort of visa for workers dedicated to harvesting crops or working on farms. So whether or not this case helps calls for that, because it impacts the level of backpacker labour that we have here in Australia, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of water to go under the bridge, but certainly for those who are advocating for a specific visa so that we can have workers come into this country who know that they're coming here not to holiday but to work, and to work in agriculture, to work in what can be hot and dusty conditions, but are prepared to do that work, they could well use this to strengthen their call, I'd imagine.
Be interesting to see what happens. Kath, thanks so much for the update.
That's Kath Sullivan reporting there. It is 13 past 12 here on the Country Hour. So what do farmers make of all of this? Do they see it as a win? Well, here's what Victorian Farmers Federation Vice President Emma Germano had to say about the ruling.
To be honest, that it had kind of dropped off everybody's radar, but we did hear in February of last year that this was going to court. And at the time we said, isn't the backpacker tax the gift that keeps on giving? To be honest, I would have anticipated that the result would have been as it has been today, which is to say there's an agreement between the countries that you can't disproportionately tax, the residents of another country. It seemed fairly straightforward, and the judgment has reflected that.
What sort of ramifications could this finding have in terms of backpacker labour in this country?
Well, that's actually a really good question. Hopefully, what we were lobbying for at the time was we were saying, don't tax these people more. We don't want to see them taxed. We struggle to get people on farms as it is. We might see that there might be a pickup in the number of backpackers that come in. It might have no effect at all. It'll be really interesting to see the administrative changes now that have to happen in businesses that are used to now, again, you know, taxing the backpackers at 15% and having to register with the ATO to employ them to tax them that amount in the first place. So what a waste of time and energy.
So it's been almost 3 years since the Parliament legislated that 15% backpacker tax. What impact has that had on backpacker labour, particularly in horticulture?
We saw at the time while the debacle was being debated that the numbers really dropped off, and there were a few reasons that that might have occurred, you know, alongside just the really negative commentary around the backpacker tax. Numbers have started to improve. There's also been changes made to that 417 visa over the last few years in regards to expanding it to more countries, and also now there's the third year working holiday visa that you can apply for. So we've seen some changes that have meant that we're seeing more backpackers come in. But industry has been saying basically for the last 3 or 5 years that backpackers alone are not the solution to getting crops harvested. So, yeah, it's just more of the government making errors that, you know, the small businesses and the farmers have to compensate for.
And this ruling today, what sort of message do you fear that might send to potential workers?
Well, hopefully it'll say to them that, you know, even if the politicians get it wrong, the courts will get it right eventually for you. So, you know, that it's advantaged the workers from that perspective. Come to Australia and pick fruit, and at least the farmers will be lobbying on your behalf is what I would say, because we did at the time, and I'm pleased to see that, you know, it's been vindicated that all of that talk through politicians and just the absolute carry-on and all the lobbying that happened was really all for nothing. They simply got it wrong and wasted all of everybody's time and money.
That is VFF Vice President Emma Germano speaking with Cath Sullivan.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
We're at 16 past 12. Around 30,000 cows have been sold out of the Cahuna District alone in the past 18 months as the price of irrigation water continues to wreak havoc on the industry. Now, some of those cows were culls that would have been sold anyway, but many were core breeding stock. As we've heard, the price of water has climbed to almost $1,000 a megalitre in the district, far more than dairy farmers can pay to grow their own feed. Alan Mitchell from Charles L. King & Co. in Cahuna says the sell-off equates to around $120 million in annual income that's been removed from the district.
Yeah, well, current milk prices, they're probably somewhere between $3,000 and $4,000 gross income per cow, and that's direct money out of the coffers of the local farmers, which obviously has another flow-on effect to local suppliers and retail outlets within the community, not only in my area but also surrounding areas.
So that rough figure's coming out at $120 million. That sounds like a pretty massive hit to a small community or to several small communities.
Yeah, well, look, we are a changing landscape at Cahuna. We're certainly going through a transition period, not only because of the dry spell, but some of the implications of the Murray-Darling Basin plan, which is, has blown out some of the dry predicament we're in as well.
Now, where have those cows gone, Alan? Have any of them been sold to other dairy farmers, or have they just been sent to abattoirs?
Oh, look. Predominantly, a lot of them have gone to the Gippsland region, which has been a bit of a godsend for us. We've been able to, not much above the chopper price, mind you. They've certainly helped us out. We've got cows away, but some, no doubt, have gone through the abattoirs. That's for sure, and we've probably had a twofold or a double-sorted effect. We're in a blue tongue exclusion zone for export of cattle, Friesian cattle to China. So we've been unable to obtain that market as well. So we've had to take a cut in that.
The farmers that you've worked with in selling these cows, Alan, what's been the toll for them selling cows that they never wanted to sell and maybe never thought they'd have to sell?
It's certainly been hard on the families and the individual farmers themselves, and just talking with them, it certainly wasn't the way they thought they were going to retire or exit the industry. But there's been various, I guess, outcomes for those people that have retired from the dairy sector. Some have kept some cattle on. and relied on the rainfall, but you know, obviously that's dried up in the last 3 months. To feed those animals, they tried to cut hay, do other things, bought some beef cattle perhaps, but given the temporary water price at $1,000 at the moment, well, you know, irrigating is not an option at the moment. It's more likely to be buying fodder, and that's not going to happen either.
And a lot of that sell-off over the past 18 months has happened in the context of a water price maybe $500 or $600 a megalitre. But now, correct, as you say, spiking up toward $1,000. So does that mean that this sell-off is just going to continue or get worse?
I'm not sure that it's going to get worse. Obviously, farmers that are still moving here at the moment have changed the way they farm. Ones that are here have decided that they're going to continue on. They've started to join their cows at the moment, so they're at least going to purchase their enough fodder to get through till this time next year, or certainly till the spring of next year. But they've changed the way they're farming. There's a margin, they're telling me, between the milk price and the fodder price. But we're just not irrigation farmers anymore. We seem to be feedlotters. And we have to accept that. We have to change our way of farming.
So what is the future for the Cahuna District as a dairy region?
Look, it's really a crystal ball question, Angus. I'm not quite sure where we're at the moment. I think we're going through a transition period at the moment. There are some farmers that are resigned to the fact that they'll never milk cows again, and their dairies are laying idle. And to exit that property, well, they've got to take a reduced price in the land. And in saying that, you know, we're not selling any properties at the moment either. If we are, they're certainly at a reduced rate. Yeah, we're a changing landscape, and I'm just not sure where it's going to end.
Alan Mitchell from Charles L. King & Co. in Cahuna, speaking there with Angus Verley. Well, it's not just happening in Cahuna. Further north, generations of prime breeding cows are being trucked off to the sale yards and abattoirs from around a pretty wide area of New South Wales, with a lack of water and feed, seeing more producers opting to cash in and get out. Across five sites at Scone, Singleton, Tamworth, Gunnedah and Dubbo, almost 100,000 head of cattle have been sold so far this year. Now, the percentage of females slaughtered has reached 54%. That means herd liquidation is accelerating. So what does it mean for the future of breeding herds? Amelia Bernasconi has more.
Meat and Livestock Australia projects more than 8 million head of adult cattle will be sent to abattoirs across the country this year. That's up by 7% on 2018. And in the 12 months to date, one in two have been females. Breeders and agents are concerned about the national herd diminishing and how breeding lines will be rebuilt once the drought breaks. Scone Livestock agent Peter McCallum estimates more than 70% of local breeding stock have already been offloaded.
I can remember saying 8 or 9 months ago that I thought we were down to about 30% of what it was. We're way less than that now. I know a lot of our clients have totally destocked. You know, the genetics that are disappearing, it's quite alarming, really. And going forward, it takes years to put these herds together. So it's all virtually just disappearing. And how they'll get them going again, I don't know.
Martindale farmer Pauline Sykes is one of many who have held on in hope but now watched their last breeders leave the farm.
We've always had cattle. We've just always had cattle. So it's not a big property. We're one of those small family farms that grows cows to sell vealers. We just can't face the coming summer. We've lost our water and we cannot face buying in feed and water all summer to keep 20 cows going. So we've come down from about 100 cows 3 years ago when the rain got turned off, and we've sold a couple of times now already and sold down, but this is only October. We've lost our water, we've grown no feed, and so we just can't face it. So the decision had to be made to destock, and I mean, we're one of many across the state and across the country, but it doesn't make it any easier.
But processors' demand from export markets is driving strong prices despite more females coming through. MLA senior market analyst Adam Cheatham says rapid destocking rates are meeting a hungry international market.
China in particular is driving demand to sort of record levels given the outbreak of African swine fever in the country. But also competing markets such as US, Japan and Korea are obviously involved in the competition for product. Of course, we expect in the event of a solid break, we're going to see a contraction in supply domestically, and of course price support from that. In terms of export demand next year, we're looking at China, who could potentially have anywhere from a 20 million to 40 million tons carcass weight deficit in their protein supply from that pork deficit.
The latest MLA figures show the national herd has dropped back to 25.5 million head.
So the long-term average is typically around 28 million head. So we're significantly back from that level. But at 25.5 million head, I think it's always important to remember there's still plenty of livestock out there. But of course, the priority is for conditions to improve and initiate that rebuild phase. But as and when that occurs is really an unknown at this stage.
In the Upper Hunter, it's a lack of water that's driving farmers to de-stock, but it's keeping abattoirs busy.
A lot of rivers and dams and creeks are drying up. People are actually running out of water, Amelia, so, you know, the need to get rid of them is now becoming pretty drastic. But I don't think people are actually getting what they should be getting for a lot of these breeding stock, and, you know, they could be looking at prices double this when it eventually does break up. So I think the demand's there, but it's the abattoir space and the ability to handle the numbers that are coming forward. You know, a lot of cases, abattoirs are booked out for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And people that are running out of water, you know, can't wait that long.
And as some push on waiting for the big break, others will be questioning just how they get back into the game once the drought turns around.
I don't know where we rebuild from. The number of females and the percentage of females that are leaving the land, that are going through the sales, and the percentage rate of females to steers through the sale yards is just getting higher and higher and higher. Where do we rebuild from? The animals aren't here, they're gone. It's frightening really to think, how do we as an agricultural nation come back from this? And it's not just the cattle, but it's the cropping and everything too.
I know people are terribly resilient. They'll get up and get going again, but it's going to be hard.
That's Agent Peter McCallum ending that report from Amelia Bernasconi. A few of your texts coming through as well. If you'd like to send a text through this afternoon, of course you can. 0467 842 722 is the text number. 0467 842 722. We were talking earlier about that federal court ruling on the backpacker tax not being allowed to be eligible for a number of countries. Sally from the Mallee sent a text through on that saying our Danish backpacker has improved efficiencies on our farm by 140%. He does the work of 5 Australian loader drivers. We have to encourage these skilled workers to come here on working holidays and not scare them off with petty taxes. 0467 842 722 is the text number.
The Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, if you travel to Grampians Winery, Mount Langidgeran, you now have the option to get some wine, but also spread out a rug for a picnic. And if you think it's a pitch to try and grab the attention of tourists visiting the region, you're pretty much correct. The winery has invested in tourism, what they're calling the picnic ideal, in a bid to try and increase their cellar door sales. They recently received a grant from the Regional Development Australia Wine Growth Fund to try and explore that side of the business. Simone Smith spoke with Damien Sheehan, viticultural and general manager, to get an insight.
I think that there's been a few reasons for doing that. To begin with, we already have a cellar door, and a lot of wineries like ourselves, they have that investment. They've made that investment and they staff the cellar door, and they have an important income stream through their wine sales. But we really wanted to try and grow that. And one of the reasons, I guess, for that is that if you look at our other opportunities for distributing our wine, the retail sector's really consolidated over the last sort of 10, 15 years. And the opportunities there aren't always as profitable, I guess, as a channel. And whereas wine sales, direct wine sales in a cellar door environment, that's probably the most profitable sale we can make. So we wanted to really try and boost that activity. And that's probably kind of the main driver behind it.
So tell us a little bit about your distribution channels, because you also export wine as well.
Yeah, that's right. So about 50% of what we produce goes to export markets. Then we distribute our wine nationally, and so that goes to restaurants and small independent retailers. And then you've got your large retailers dominated really by Woolworths and Coles.
So we're sitting here looking over your Shiraz grapes, and behind us are two customers who are tasting wines at the cellar door. What sort of return on investment do you get in tourism though, and how do you manage that? Or, you know, is it better off directing funds to something where you know you're going to get a return, such as your export?
That's the unknown quantity to a degree, because we're more, I suppose our expertise lies more in the marketing and retailing of wine, and the tourism component, it's a bit of a new field for us to get involved in, and it's something we're still learning a lot about. So opening the doors, having customers come in and buy wine, as I said, it's the most profitable sale we can make, but quantifying that in terms of the amount that you invest in the cellar door, the experiences you develop, is still sort of learning and feeling our way through that.
And it would also, you know, need to be a new skill set, I guess, because you're a viticulturalist by trade and there's tractors driving around here. You are a farmer. So how do you get those skills for tourism?
Yeah, well, luckily the government's really been supporting that activity, especially the state government and also the federal government. Our industry, the wine industry, has really picked up on the wine tourism as really, I guess, a new revenue stream for our business. And there's been a lot of support given through structured workshops and what have you. But I think what's been great for us is just to get a bit more involved with the regional tourism organisations and also speaking to people that are really well and truly involved in the tourism industry and understanding how they go about doing it.
So this Grampians wine region, it's quite an old wine region. It's not necessarily expanding in terms of hectares, but you were saying before that it's the values being added. Can you explain to us how that works?
The region's grown a little bit in the last 20 years. It hasn't been exponential, that's for sure, but I think that people are starting to see the quality that comes out of this region, and we're attracting some really good operators. And so there's been a little bit of development in terms of small vineyards established and small brands established that they have ambitions to grow, and that's really good. But I think more than that is the people that have been operating in this region for a while have embraced the tourism ideals, I guess, and they're looking to really develop that side of their business and make it more of an attraction for just the general tourist as well as the wine tourist. And that sort of puts the place on the map then, I guess you could say.
If we were to look forward, say, 5 years, how much would tourism be contributing to your bottom dollar as a winery?
Gee, that's a $64,000 question. I think that it would depend on the size of your operation. So, as I said, we've got distribution nationally and also we export. We hope that it'll grow in terms of a revenue stream, but proportionally it'll always be a smaller part of our revenue.
So is the challenge here for your cellar door the fact that you are remote?
Yes, for sure. We're off the beaten track, I guess, and we need to work pretty hard on getting dispersion from the main tourist destinations, I guess. It's a little bit more difficult when you're remote like we are. We've got a strong wine brand, and so people that know their wines well recognise the brand, and we get a lot of visitation out of that. But working on the more sort of the broader tourism market, that's going to take a bit of work.
That's Damien Sheehan from Mount Langidgeran, ending that report from Simone Smith. It's a 28-1 here on the Country Hour. Time to get the latest in news headlines now with Sarah Maunder. Afternoon, Sarah.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. Police have ramped up the search for a Gippsland couple missing in Victoria's high country since Monday. Guy and Susan Beasley from Willung were last seen in Mansfield on Monday afternoon after visiting friends in Seymour. Searchers will scour a 90-kilometre stretch of the Jamison-Licola Road where mobile phone reception is poor. The pair are travelling in a Land Rover four-wheel drive. A 35-year-old woman has been charged with one count of dangerous driving causing death following a fatal crash near Mildura yesterday. A man who is yet to be formally identified died after a car crashed into several trees on an unsealed road at Calignan after 7 o'clock yesterday. The woman is due to appear in Mildura Magistrates Court today. An 18-year-old Tarnate man has been charged with murder following the death of a Colac man in Geelong this week. The 41-year-old victim was found with life-threatening injuries at Eastern Beach on Monday night, but died in hospital yesterday morning. The teenager is due to appear in the Geelong Magistrates Court today. A Ballarat jury will continue to deliberate in the trial of a 65-year-old stallwoman charged over a car crash that killed four women in Western Victoria. Yesterday, Lorraine Nicholson was found not guilty of culpable driving over the collision, but the jury is still deciding on whether or not she is guilty of dangerous driving causing death. The leader of the Victorian National Party has called on the government to formally investigate the Gunawarra Shire Council. Peter Walsh told Parliament on Tuesday that allegations of bullying by members of council had been passed on to him. Mr Walsh cited the stalled development of the Kahuna Airport as an example of how council problems were negatively affecting the community. In a statement, Council CEO Tom O'Reilly said the council is high-performing and that it acts in the best interests of all its ratepayers based on facts rather than political opinion. For more news, head to abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Sarah Maunder there with news headlines. Now let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster on duty is Richard Carline. Afternoon, Richard.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
And I gather we've got some very warm temperatures in the far east of the state.
Yes, generally warm right throughout the state with temperatures close to 30 or in the low 30s, but Gippsland tops the list, Bairnsdale 35.1, Orbost 34.9, and that is significant for the southeast because that is nearing all-time record highs for October. That Orbost figure of 34.9, that equals its highest October temperature, and we think the records might go back to the 1880s.
Wow.
We'll have to check that. And Bairnsdale 35.1 is very close to its all-time record. We've got records going back there since the early 1940s. And East Sale, very close to its October record, with records going back to World War II as well. So we'll have to check those out. For the northwest of the state, you can get temperatures close to 40 degrees, so no records there. So most areas aren't near record pace. It's just the Gippsland area. And they've probably got another degree or so to go through the afternoon. So all-time October records. And that's because a high over the Tasman Sea is directing these warm northerly winds. It should stay dry for the rest of the day, mainly sunny with moderate northerly winds freshening in western and central areas. Now, tomorrow it'll start out that way with fine conditions during the morning, but a change approaching, that trough moving into the southwest later tomorrow afternoon. And ahead of that, we'll see cloud building up and some showers and thunderstorms will develop in the west through that mid to late afternoon period. That change will move to central Victoria later in the day and bring the showers and storms as well. And the difference with this change compared to the last few months is that we do have a tropical link. We've seen tropical moisture from Queensland head southward across western New South Wales today, and that should lie over the state tomorrow. So very tropical air mass ahead of that front, and we're likely to see some active showers and storms in the west tomorrow. Probably will end up with a severe thunderstorm warning, I think, at some stage later tomorrow for western areas with that storm activity. Then moving into Saturday, the change slows down over central Victoria before drifting into the east, and the humidity just keeps building ahead of it, and the unstable conditions continue. So we'll have showers and thunderstorms, mainly over central and eastern parts of the state, tending to rain over the northeast, slowly contracting eastwards, that humid tropical air mass moving towards the east. In the west, behind it, we'll have isolated showers to follow, mainly in the south. And we could easily end up in central and eastern areas with falls of 20 to 50 millimetres, with some isolated falls to 80 millimetres during Saturday, given the nature of the showers and storms. So I think we'll end up tomorrow issuing severe weather warnings as well for Saturday for heavy rain in those parts, and also possibly strong winds in the Alpine area. That activity doesn't really move out of the east until Sunday afternoon. It's confined to the eastern third of the state on Sunday, heading eastwards. But it won't clear until Sunday mid-afternoon, with isolated showers to follow in southern areas. So over 3 days, some areas in the east could end up with falls above 100 millimetres. That's mainly on the eastern ranges or slightly on the northeastern side, but still some totals in Gippsland are likely to be well over 50 millimetres. As we move into next week, it looks like a much simpler weather pattern, some milder weather, weak cold fronts moving through Bass Strait, bringing a few showers to the south at times. but we'll keep conditions quite mild. We may have some coastal wind warnings, but we lose that humidity and that that heavy rain. So a very active period, I think, starting tomorrow afternoon, and that could persist until Sunday afternoon in the east.
Mm. So does anybody miss out on the rain altogether?
Depends on the storm activity tomorrow night. If somewhere in the west misses out on that storm activity tomorrow, and that's possible because I think at first it will be a bit hit or miss, they're the areas that are likely to miss out. But I think in central and eastern Victoria, they'll be very unlucky to miss this heavy rain because it's just going to pull in that area. And the system's so slow moving that most areas there should get a high amount of rainfall.
Okay, thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks, Nick.
Richard Carline, senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 21 to 1. My name's Nikolai Bailhart. So let's keep talking about rain, but look a little further afield. You might have seen that there has been some rain falling across drought-ravaged parts of Queensland, and there's also some forecasts for some pretty decent falls in parts of New South Wales this weekend as well. Now, obviously, a lot of people will be keeping a close eye on that, but is it too early to speculate what these rains might mean for livestock markets? Well, Simone Smith asked Robert Herman from market analysis firm Mercado this very question.
I don't think it is too early to speculate because we've got to understand that the major areas that have been impacted by this rain are summer rainfall areas. So we're getting towards the summer. So the possibility of them getting good rainfall is more likely into the future than what it was in the past. That said, we know that it doesn't rain grass, but you have to start rain somewhere to get to rain grass, if you like, and this could be the start of it. So it's not too early to speculate, but it's worth watching closely.
With that in mind, what could it possibly mean?
Well, one of the things that will mean is that there will be reduced amount of stock going into the sale yards when it rains. And in the first instance, farmers take an optimistic view. They say, well, it's rained. I can just wait and see. I don't need to keep destocking because I don't have any feed. I can just hold off and wait and see. We've also got to remember, Simone, that we've now got a cow herd in Australia of about 25 million, and that's about 2 million less than the average we've had since 2000. So it's quite a low herd, and we've got a record low sheep flock. The sheep flock has never been this low. Well, the last time it was this low was in 1900. Or 1898. So we're going to find that not only will the numbers coming to market decrease, but they're coming off a very low base of the flock.
So we're talking about what this could mean for those in Queensland and New South Wales, but I know there's plenty of farmers in Victoria and South Australia who've been refreshing the Bureau app constantly. What does this mean for southern markets?
It has a big impact on southern markets because the markets on the East Coast are all interrelated. You know, people used to say, if Queensland sneezes, Victoria catches a cold in the cattle market. And that's true because if the supply is impacted from the big cattle producing state, which is Queensland, then it'll impact on demand and in our southern areas. Of course, we're also coming into the weaner cattle sales. So if there is a more optimistic outlook for feed in the north, given the low numbers of cattle that are about, those potential buyers will head south. In terms of the sheep flock, you've only got to have a look at lamb prices and mutton prices to see that there will be a real appetite for people to rebuild the flock, rebuild their sheep flocks when they can. And so that'll start with these first rains. The big question, though, is what comes next in those areas. And we know some of those areas that have got rain or on the edge of these good rain have had, you know, up to 3 years of really low rainfall and poor conditions.
You mentioned the weaner cattle sales. They come up after Christmas. Will that be enough time for people to feel confident about restocking, assuming these rains keep coming and, you know, the best case scenario plays out?
Well, I think that's a good question. There's going to be some caution, but on the other hand, we know that farmers are generally optimistic, and farmers know that if they're going to be successful as farmers, they've got to be productive, and to be productive, you've got to have livestock. So if you don't have livestock now, you're going to try and restock as quickly as you can in a reasonable way. The other factor, though, in the weaner cattle sales is that not all of Australia is in drought. So there's large tracts of Victoria and South Australia and Tasmania where, given these good prices, these good commodity prices, whether it's for lamb or cattle, there will be good demand for store animals that are being sold. And the weaner cattle sales are a classic example where breeders, you know, breed wonderful stock, but they do need to go somewhere else to be finished generally. That demand will be about. But if we do get follow-up rains in these areas in to the north, then it could go to really unprecedented levels. And you're smiling now because I know we always get cautious when we talk about good times ahead in agriculture. Everyone's cautious about that. But we know that the outlook for meat, red meat, that demand is really strong.
Unprecedented levels. Mm. Can you talk us through what restocking will look like if we've got such high prices? Because some of these people haven't had incomes. And then even down here in the south, they might want to replace stock, but we're talking shelling out lots of money.
Yeah, and that's a big challenge. And that's an area that I know that the government and NFF are concerned about is where does that capital come from? How is it financed? How is it funded? Just on the level of price, though, I mean, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator in the last peak got to around 700 cents or 750 or something like that for a short period of time. Today it's at mid 500s. But we've got to remember that today's young cattle indicator has virtually zero restocking activity pushing the price. So the 500 to 600 cent level is historically a very strong level, and that's being driven by meat demand, and meat demand specifically into our strong markets. So the US, Japan, Korea, and the emerging markets, China and other Asian countries. So the underlying strong price for the cattle at the moment is for the demand for slaughtered cattle. What really ramps things up, though, is when restocker demand kicks in. So restocker demand could push this price quite a bit higher when it comes. And as you rightly point out, to have restocker demand, you have to have grass. And for that to happen, you need rain. This might be the first stage. So there's all those steps, but it will eventually rain. And that will position the red meat markets in really good stead.
Robert Herman from Mercado ending that report.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Nikolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour.
Well, last week it was announced that the commencement date would be the start of next year ahead of schedule for the mandatory code of conduct in the dairy industry. The code is trying to set rules between how processors can treat their dairy farm suppliers and what's acceptable in these contracts. And part of the aim of that is to balance the power between those two parties. Bega Cheese Chairman Max Roberts says the draft mandatory code of conduct will leave farmers disappointed and says it should go further.
With the pricing structure, especially around the domestic market, it's pretty disheartening to see some of your products sold so cheaply on the supermarket shelf. And I just know when I was dairy farming, you'd walk in and you'd just walk along and shake your head and think, nah, that just doesn't look right.
Well, farmers might say, well, you're the processor, don't you have any power up against these supermarkets?
The supermarkets carry all the weight, and that's the issue, that they can call in competition from any other part of Australia or indeed any other part of the world to compete against your product or the price that you've submitted.
So the industry's bringing in a mandatory code of conduct. Will that make a difference to dairy farmers?
I worry about that mandatory code of conduct in that it's creating expectations that might not be met. And I think the real issue with it is that it doesn't go right through to the end of the supply chain. It only goes sort of halfway. And Bega is quite happy with the code of conduct, and we don't have a problem there. But I think they probably should have fought for a little more and got it right through to the supermarket.
That's Bega Cheese Chairman Max Roberts speaking with Josh Becker. It's 13-1 here on the Country Hour. Well, it appears that southwestern Victoria has a somewhat unique problem at the moment. It's one of the latest hotspots for Australian agriculture. Lots of farmers are keen to get a piece of high rainfall country, but there aren't always enough farms to meet demand. Simone Smith spoke with Angus Shaw from property valuer Heron Todd White about the current local market.
There's been limited activity, but it's been largely restricted by the amount of assets on the market, and that's keeping the value quite high, as well as the high rainfall in the southwest districts of Victoria in comparison to much of the east state. The region's been going quite well, which has maintained high property prices over the last couple of years.
What sort of premium are we talking on, say, 5 years ago?
We're looking at sort of double in a lot of instances on values of 5 years ago. Things have really heated up in the last 3 to 4 years, and they're not stopping at the moment. Values that we're seeing in recent sales are continuing to push record levels.
What's driving these prices?
Strong grain prices in some areas and the weather conditions in a lot of areas. We are seeing some some New South Wales and Queensland buyers come down chasing grass in both southeast South Australia and the Western Districts in those high rainfall belts, viewed as secure rainfall. So there are guys that don't have grass up north that are chasing that to keep stock alive or provide fodder to stock up north. We have had obviously above longer term average commodity prices in most commodities, which has also helped, along with a number of things being low interest rates, so I guess cheap money.
What does this mean for those who already have a farm here? Their values are obviously going up, but are they looking to expand, or is it just that bit too expensive?
We're definitely seeing some guys go very hard just because the money's cheap and interest rates are cheap. So we're seeing, I guess, a bit of a divide, with some conservative buyers saying it's too expensive and not buying and holding out of the market. But we're seeing a lot of guys buy and at record prices and continuing to improve. And I guess that big get bigger, and that's how the market's going.
Where do you see prices going in the next couple of years?
Given that bond rates have just fallen and interest rates are likely to stay low, I imagine that we'll continue to see values continue to rise for the next sort of 12 or 18 months, but depends what happens with commodity prices and weather and, I guess, the Australian dollar, Trump, that sort of thing.
Heron Todd White, a valuer, is right across Australia. So how does the southwest Victorian, southeast South Australia experience compared to elsewhere in the country?
Seen a number of areas come back, especially up Queensland and New South Wales, and that's largely weather dependent. It is a bit cyclical and depending on the commodity, but in the grazing space, Queensland, New South Wales markets are usually in front of the southern markets. We're still seeing good interest in Tasmania as well, and that's continuing to improve, whereas the Queensland markets have perhaps come back a bit, and given the weather events, there's a lot more supply on the market that there's not down south.
Spring is traditionally property selling season in southwest Victoria, but this year there are actually more grazing and cropping farms for sale, according to Nick Adamson, rural sales specialist and director of Western Victorian real estate agency Charles Stewart.
Last year we had a lot of dairy farms on the market and sold them. It was almost a clearinghouse type situation where, due to people wanting seasonal security and feed from the north, a lot of farms down here, I think we sold 16 out of Warnable office, and 13 of those went to graziers. Only three returned to dairying, which reflects about 80%. Of that 80% that was sold to graziers, 60% were sold to locals, let's say local farmers wanting to consolidate, and local businessmen. The other 40% were sold from people from drought-affected areas, anywhere from the river country on the Murray into New South Wales, the Riverina, the Wimmera and the Mallee, the Murray Bridge area of South Australia, the Riverland area of South Australia. So we've seen that happen last year. That has continued into this financial year, and this spring, the inquiry, I've fielded calls for grazing particularly, but they'd also look at dairy farms to convert to grazing as far away as, you know, Longreach and Canamble, which is a long, long way away from Warrnambool.
Do you have enough farms to meet all this demand?
At the moment, there's more demand than supply. With the inspections on most properties are into double figures, regardless of size and value. Historically, that's more than most. You know, a lot of farms would have, you know, five and six inspections on. Historically, most of the properties we have out there now were well into double figures.
It's Charles Stewart, Director Nick Adamson, ending that report. It's 8 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Well, digging up paddocks to try and stop valuable topsoil from blowing away is almost unheard of these days. It did happen a lot, though, in past droughts. And it's what Chris Hunt has resorted to doing on his farm in the Millawa, which has received less than 50 millimetres of rain in parts this year. He spoke with our rural reporter, Angus Furley.
Yeah, look, we're just setting up the old chisel plier last week with every second tine lifted, so it's effectively a 28-inch space, and then just with an old-school set of 2-inch reversible chisels on it, just with an aim to make a bit of country that's got a fair bit of sand drifting across it rough to try and hold it there.
So you're going to go in and rip that up?
Yeah, we will, yeah. Yep, so just go in slow with the whole aim of making it rough, bring up clods, make furrows, make ridges, yeah, to try and resist the wind and stop it sweeping as bad as it is.
And how bad has it been?
Oh, look, I'm pretty lucky. I've only got one isolated pocket, and it's just near the highway and needs dealing with. But, yeah, there is some pretty shocking erosion out and about in the area.
And you said your neighbour also interested in doing the same thing?
Yeah, he's got a bit of country to do, so he was giving us a hand to set it up. Yeah, he's done a bit. I'm not sure how he's got on. But, yeah, just try and contain it, I guess.
Have you done it in the past?
Not really, but this year at seeding, it really highlighted how effective ridges, furrows and clods can be. We had a lot of vulnerable country that we managed to get covered this year, just, I think, purely because we got in and we got a dry sowing, but we had made ridges, we had made furrows, and we had pulled some clods up and went relatively slow, so we didn't find the country. And, yes, we had some stuff that was very messy, and it actually, yeah, it's got it through to a crop.
And, Chris, I suppose we're just at the start of summer now, so are you getting in early, I suppose, expecting that there could be some pretty tough conditions over the next few months and taking a preemptive sort of measure?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Look, it's going to be a pretty ugly summer at the rate it's progressing. If something changes, like the wind's been pretty relentless, and that's probably the last 18 months, you know, it's been dry, but that relentless wind from the southwest, it's done a massive amount of damage.
And digging up a paddock, I suppose, pretty unusual these days when a lot of people are no-till and controlled traffic, but I suppose it's just something that you need to do?
Yeah, well, yeah, we really don't work any ground as a rule. I think the last time we would have worked any country was about 2014 on a bit of new country we took on. So, yeah, we really, as a rule, don't work too much country and don't generally have the need to.
And moving on, Chris, I think you started harvest at your place?
Yeah, look, the header started late last week. It's been a bit of a slow process over the weekend. Due to that wind, conditions were pretty ordinary on Friday, Saturday, but yeah, we're into it now. Really full steam into it. The header's got some work committed elsewhere down south, so we need to keep it rolling to meet our commitments for other people.
And people have probably seen pictures or videos of the mellower of paddocks, which are just dirt. But that's not every paddock, Chris. You do have a harvest.
Yeah, we do. Look, I actually, every paddock we've seeded for cereal grain will see the header. There will be some that won't, you know, it'll only be a very small amount, but you'd like to think our worst would be seed back. And, yeah, the best, I'd like to think, is a fair bit more than that.
And how much rain have you had for the year?
Look, I'm a bit lapsy-daisy with rainfall records, but we range, I think, from about 45 mil to about 70 mil, depending on where we are, because we've got country over basically from the east end of the Millawa to the west end of the Millawa. We've got bits and pieces, so yeah, we're not that big operation, but we cover a fair area.
And are you surprised, even yourself, that you have been able to grow a crop on such little rain?
Yeah, look, it's pretty amazing.
That's Chris Hunter, farmer in the Millawa, speaking there with Angus Fairley. Time for the livestock market, starting at Bairnsdale with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nikolai. Numbers decreased to 400. That's 70 fewer than the sale of a fortnight ago, with the usual buyers operating in a dearer market in places. Quality was mixed with more finish throughout. Trade cattle sold to firm demand, plainer young cattle lifted. Grown steers and bullocks improved 10 cents. Heavy beef cows sold firm, plainer lightweight cows gained up to 15 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 410 to 488 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lost 10 to 20 cents. A handful of vealers reached a top of 315, yearling trade steers 305 to 322, heifers to the trade 255 to 307, grown steers and bullocks 293 to 317, most light and medium weight cows 172 to 219, heavyweights 190 to 253, heavy bulls 240 to 265. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Now to Colac and Eric Estrain.
Quality overall was average in the reduced-sized mixed selection of 229 cattle here at Colac, 153 less. Competition was not as keen, though good quality sold at firm prices, but plain and older cattle were discounted from 5 to 20 cents and even up to 25 cents a kilogram. The sea mussel vealers and yearlings made 215 to 290 cents with a single B3 at 310. Restockers paid from 235 to 268. The odd C3 grown steers sold at 245 and 290 cents with D2 manufacturing steers between 220 and 260. Three score grown heifers made 245 to 262 cents with restockers at 269. The odd few heavyweight beef cows sold at 238 and 240 cents with the D2 cows from 215 to 230. D1 cows made 180 to 210 cents and E1 cows sold from 160 to 185. Heavyweight B2 beef bulls made between 250 and 300 cents to average 5 cents dearer. It's been Eric Australian reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Eric. And now to Wagga and Leanne Dax.
28,000 lambs and just over 22,000 sheep sold at Wagga. Not all buyers are in attendance and not all major processors operated. Quality was very mixed this week, with longer wool lambs very dry while others needed more finish. The market also lacked weight. Domestic buyers were more selective, resulting in trade lambs selling 3 to 4 cheaper. Light trade 146 to 160, medium trade 160 to 182, averaging 780 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy trades 22 to 24 kilo, 176 to 198. Heavy lambs 24 to 26 kilo, 195 to 226. The extra heavies 216 to 268, with prices bouncing around throughout the sale to finish firm, averaging 810 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Light store lamb prices dip 5 to 13, selling at $69 to 140. Lambs with more weight and frame ease back 3, 142 to 168. And light lambs to the processors, $90 to 143. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne, and that is pretty much it for the Country Hour for today. Just a reminder, full explanation of those changes, or the court ruling, I should say, about the backpacker tax, finding that it was discriminatory. So it looks like there will be some uncertain future about the backpacker tax and who it will be applied to. If you want to know all the details of that and what the court found, you can find the details up on our website. That address, of course, is abc.net.au/rural. It's news time. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.